Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. This episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Tastes of Better event in Ascot in April 2024. The session was titled Culinary Insights, Exploring the Latest Gastronomic Trends and Innovations. Our panel discusses the latest developments in this area and how an increased prominence of sustainability, provenance, and cultural diversity are affecting the types of culinary innovations we're seeing. Your host is the Managing Director of the Sustainable Restaurant Association, Julianne Calloit-Noble.
I'm going to let you each introduce yourselves. And as we do that, I'm going to start with an icebreaker question. So as we're here today to talk about trends and what's inspiring us, I'd like you all to think about the start of your careers as chefs and something that was really trendy then that now we all roll our eyes at and kind of has fallen by the wayside. So Jamie, maybe you can introduce yourself and pick that up.
Okay, yeah, so I'm Jamie Robinson. I'm the executive chef for Tesco. I've been with Tesco now nearly 6 years and been in role for 5 years. I always joke at things like this, I'll get challenged, but I think I've got the best job in our industry, to be honest. I'm very lucky in what I do. I get to travel the world, eat in some incredible restaurants, work with some incredible people, but ultimately, my day-to-day, I sit in a very small group of people within our product development team. So 53 in our direct team, and there's 10 within my core team. Four of us are culinary focused, and our job is to set the direction for future product and trends within Tesco. So we look after events, seasonal operations, and education for product development and the wider team, and that spans out into our supply base as well. Give me your thing that was trendy
and then no longer, how you really rise at.
Well, I've got two things, and they kind of link. I think one of my earliest inspirations when I first started cooking was Charlie Trotter. Any old chefs in the room will know Charlie Trotter. Yeah. It's a bit sad, really. I remember trying to make recipes or recreate recipes out of his books and, like, scratching my head because I just couldn't make them work because my skill level was just so low at that point in time. And it was a case of, like, trial and error. And I got to a point I'd make these delicious desserts and then just chuck icing sugar all over them. And I guess that's the bit I'm glad we've moved away from, little shakers of icing sugar on every single dessert that we send out of a kitchen.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All right, on to you, Tim.
Yep, my name is Tim Sheed. My background is sort of five-star, Michelin-star restaurants and hotels, and I'm currently found over at Fairmont Windsor Park, just local, the other side of Windsor Great Park. As a hotel, it's 250 bedrooms, 7 food outlets, of which I manage 5 of them. So my day-to-day is still very much kitchen, still very much cooking, and liaising with customers as well. I'm very much customer-driven. My food trend, I guess, when I first sort of got into the industry was, I think Heston had just released his book, and so sort of throughout the industry, I think there was knockoffs and chemistry that was probably done by people that shouldn't have really tried it. I'm so glad to sort of, I still very much like seeing it done well, but not everywhere.
Yes, fair enough. Not quite all molecular gastronomists.
Doesn't need to be, no.
Yeah. All right, Stephen, over to you.
Yeah, afternoon all. My name's Stephen Humphreys. I'm executive development chef for Vacheron, which is a boutique contract caterer in London. We have over 100 sites across the city, over 1,000 employees, around 250 of them are chefs. I predominantly look after the hospitality side of things, and my day-to-day could be anything from cooking fine dinings to I've got a sandwich presentation tomorrow morning, talking on panels, a little bit of everything, really. So mine's a dish, actually.
Give it to me.
So when I first started out many moons ago, fillet rossini was, like, I was in awe of this dish.
Yeah.
And now it's fallen away as time's developed. We've found out how bad foie gras really is. Yeah. So that's fallen away now. But we do a dish now, which is a fillet rossini, but we use a watermelon So instead of the foie gras, so we dehydrate the watermelon overnight, and then we cook that in butter, and it gives you this buttery foie gras texture. And on the beef, you can't even tell it's melon, so it's, yeah, delicious. It's reinventing.
Yeah.
A little bit of innovation already for you.
Yeah, I love it. Okay. I love it. And Chris, over to you.
Yeah, I'm Chris Baber. I'm a chef, I guess, gradually turned into what you'd call a content creator now. I spent 4 years working as like a resident chef for Marks & Spencer's, which I finished last year, and that saw me working more on the fresh side of the business in terms of meeting the farmers, suppliers, producers, from like Jersey raw potatoes to where they get the strawberries, and spending a lot of time with British seasonal food, which has become a big passion of mine. I now work in terms of a chefing capacity for higher end brands and cook privately for them. And then a lot of my day to day could be working with more consumer led brands in terms of delivering recipe content for their end users to cook at home. So it's very diverse in terms of what I do. I spend a lot of time in the summer at the food festivals, talking and interacting with people and cooking on stage. And then the trends, I think it's two that kind of roll into one, and it would be deconstructing things and serving them on slates.
Yeah.
So you generally go to like a gastropub and a square slate off the old roof would come out with an apple crumble with the crumble here, the apples over here,
yeah,
and like a line of custard or something. And that, like, I can't stand that. And I think we've kind of stepped away from that.
Yeah. We need to go back to constructing our food.
Exactly.
Brilliant. I'm going to start with you this time. And I guess thinking about, you know, you've got this kind of diverse day job in terms of development and creating content, creating recipes. Where are you going for inspiration at the moment? What are you looking ahead towards to get?
I think there's a lot that inspires me. I think health's become a big topic now, and I even picked up that working in the retail side of it, and it seems to be, you know, even a lot of the talks and stuff we've done today, that's always in the back of my mind. But in terms of inspiration, I'm lucky enough to live in London and have such a diverse group of friends, especially within the restaurant trade, from all over the world. That and travel, yeah, just from talking to people, industry-focused and just people I meet, it's, I think, you know, lucky enough to live in a place where you can get such authentic flavors from around the world in one place. But by all means, if I get a chance to get on a plane, I'm off.
Yeah.
I think this straight from the source.
Yeah. What about any of you guys? And you know, when you're planning menus or developing, especially in a contract catering sense, you've got so many different formats that you're looking at. Where are you going for inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, like everyone, there's inspiration everywhere you look. Everywhere that you turn, there's inspiration. You've got social medias, you've got your online research, you've got books. I love a cookbook still. And then travel is a big thing. And like Chris said, I live in London as well. Yeah. So you've got everything there. But traveling to different places. I mean, every time we book a holiday, my wife's eyes roll because there's a restaurant or there's a type of cuisine or there's something there to do with catering that I want to go and investigate, basically. So, yeah, the travel.
Cool.
And then, yeah, and also the chefs I've worked with in the past, but with a lot of great chefs in different countries, so that inspires me.
Anything to add there, or do you guys want a new question?
Oh, I mean, just sort of backing onto that, it's... I talk a lot within the industry. I think that's really helpful to see what the trends are, see what people are selling, what's working well with one sort of hotel or restaurant. How does that sort of imply with the greater hospitality sector? Yeah.
So with that in mind, perfect segue. Jamie, what are you seeing right now as kind of key trends and things that you're excited by and kind of diving into?
What a question. So my day to day is literally exploring new foods completely. Yeah. So, good question for me. I think there's a few things, and I could go down a rabbit hole, but something I'd like to talk about today is technique.
Yeah.
I think this is a really key trend we're seeing in our space. So I'm still very much in touch with the hospitality sector. I'm lucky that I've got some good friends in restaurants. I've also got some really good people in my supply base sitting at the back that have some very good connections. So it keeps our finger on the pulse with what's happening in the industry. And I think kind of leading back into that trends piece as well, for me, a lot of what I try and do is actually is track and time. Yeah. I like look at our industry and food as a whole. It's just a big merry-go-round. Yeah. And things go round and round and round. And actually, the point you jump on is really key. So yeah. Technique, for me, would be the thing right at the front of my mind at the moment. And if we talk like charring, searing, roasting, look at prepared foods 15 years ago, and it was sausage and mash. Yeah. Ultimately, it was your microwave meals. There wasn't like a lot of excitement there. We now have specialist companies that have created control points to be able to add value to vegetables and meats and proteins by the technique they use to prepare it. And I think right on the other end of the scale, the boom in the last 5 years would have been precision fermentation through plant-based proteins and growing organisms and different fungi to recreate meat mimics. So yeah. I think they're two ends of the scale that are massively established in my world, but the cutting-edge innovation at the moment is that kind of bit wacky, weird centerpiece there around fermentation, smoking, dehydration as well would be key, and not just from a dried mango chips perspective, but actually like dehydrated stocks and stuff, so as you're rehydrating, you're getting first cook at home. So I think lacto-ferment would be, if I was to single out a single piece within that technique, we spoke just before we started, actually, I think it's absolutely everywhere. I remember 10 years ago in a development kitchen, I had a day where I just took over everywhere and fermented everything I could. And I got some really weird looks. And I got an email about 2 weeks ago from somebody I used to work with saying, I thought you was mad and now look at the world. But actually, from our world now, retail and Tesco, we're still kind of at the spearhead of how we control it in a way without taking away all the goodness from a microbiome perspective. I think that is a trend that we're facing into massively as an industry. And I think it's something we'll see boom over the next kind of 3 years within a retail space.
Yeah, brilliant. Love that, because I think, you know, as we were kind of mentioning before, it's something that cuts to this intersection between sustainability and health. And you've got, you know, all this flavor, you know, also that it's kind flavor, of world yeah. food stuff. Yeah. We're looking at other cultures and things that have been happening around the world for thousands of years in terms of fermentation. But, you know, what you're seeing is that this is a great way to, you know, deal with surplus food. It's a great way to deal with your offcuts and your leftovers. Yeah, and sure. And also we're recognizing those health impacts of yeah. our microbiome.
I think for me, anything I do and touch, it will always be a flavor-first perspective. Yeah. And I think then the depth of an idea or a trend or a shift is backed up by how many of the other boxes it ticks when it comes to a health, sustainability, control, cost, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And it's like the further you go down the list with fermented foods, you don't really find any negatives yeah. other than the fact they're volatile and explode if you don't keep them chilled.
Yeah. What about you guys? Over to you, Tim, on things that are inspiring you right now.
I'm sort of blessed in that I work with a team of people. And so when I hire for cultures as well. I look for different cultures. I look for different inspiration. So that when, you know, food trends are, they're already out there. People already know, they're just coming to the limelight. Yeah. They're already traditional ways of cooking and fermenting. And, yeah. and so by listening to different cultures, I'm able to sort of stay authentic to those cultures as well and incorporate them into menus where suitable.
Is there a particular kind of region that you're into at the moment or like something?
I'm looking more at the moment at sort of Middle Eastern. Okay. As it's a bit of, so by talking to our clientele, we can see that Middle Eastern is selling quite well at the moment for its health benefits as well. Yeah. And also Indian as well. It's a big rise in fine dining Indian.
Stephen, any kind of particular trends that you're identifying at the moment that you're leaning into?
Yeah, just sort of not Nick and Jamie's ideas, but it's very much like, because I've worked at Noma, so it's very much all about what you just discussed. And I think the Scandinavian menus aren't big at the moment, they're still popping up, but the way that they help the gut health and everything like that, they're really, I think they will become really big. Yeah. I've seen a lot of nostalgia at the moment as well, it seems to be big at the moment. And then I think we're looking at sort of regional stuff rather than Mexican.
Right.
We're looking at into the regional cooking, so it's like a Yucatan, the habanero salsa, things like this. So, and I think consumers want that now because everyone's got so much knowledge in the palm of their hand with their phone.
I think that's probably a perfect kind of segue to you, Chris, and social media and stuff. The consumer has more access to knowledge than ever before.
They do, and I think one of the positives of social and negatives is who do you listen to and who do you trust? Because I could do a post tonight saying, you know, gut health is the worst trend to ever come around. I'd stay away from any ultra-processed food. And some people will believe you. So I think it's a minefield. And through the right businesses like a Tesco or something, they have like that voice of authority. And what I did, I guess, at M&S, it's really important for them to get on the trends and give a credible voice around it or trust credible professionals. I think you've got to be so wise to make your own judgment. But I think to what is going out to the masses, gut health's huge. I think seasonality is another one, and I spent a lot of time working on that and people actually knowing where their food comes from. Yeah. And then to the other end of that spectrum is the ultra-processed plant-based alternatives that I feel like almost had a big moment, and maybe people are now questioning and if should they be eating that because of what's actually in it. And I think in terms of things coming back around, I look at like a Jamie Oliver and trend-wise, I'd say all of that school dinner stuff where it was like, me growing up, how do we remove artificial flavours, colours and preservatives was always the big thing. And you sort of come back around to now and I'm looking at some of these products like a pea protein and go, well, you've taken some peas and added all that back in. So I think it's such a complex topic. Yeah. But I think to go back to your original point, things do go round and round, don't they? Yeah. And it's getting on them at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that perfect example with you know, plant-based proteins and things, I think what we're seeing is a sort of category that's starting to mature. And so you had this absolute boom in, you know, innovation and creation and kind of saying, and this idea around the that we need to eat less meat and kind of be more flexible. And now we're starting to understand a little bit more maturely, like what does good look like in that category? And that is going to lead to some slimming in, you know, in some products that aren't going to work and how we're going to kind of see that go forward. But at the same time, you know, I think you can also then see this rebound where people will say, oh, plant-based is dead and, you know, or kind of vegetarian is dead. And
I just think it's an evolution, actually. I think it's an exciting space. It's a crazy space, but it's an exciting space. So I think we as Tesco, we kind of set that mark when we partnered with Derek Sarno 7 years ago now, I think it was. I actually think as we're seeing that market mature, and you're right, Chris, I've got an opinion on plant-based proteins. I almost see it, I think that will become like your Chinese takeaway on a Saturday night option.
Yeah.
Like how I will eat clean in the week and then I'll have a treat at the weekend if I'm having a night off. I think the meat mimics will end up in that space, but I think what it's starting to do now is pave way to an exciting new kind of added value vegetable space. Which again is that next evolution. If we look at vegan food in the 90s, it was whole foods and pulses and grains, and it's almost like we're back at that point again now where that's the next.
Totally.
We've announced some of our ambitions around plant forward as a focus for us, and it's no coincidence that it's as a point that the plant protein market's kind of matured and leveled, if you like.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely insightful, and I think you're seeing that across the, and also like exciting for us and that innovation around beans, pulses, legumes, all of that is really exciting. So you were talking a little bit, Jamie, there about flavor first and then kind of looking down the scale at these other boxes like sustainability or like health. And I guess, how do you see sustainability in particular playing a role in development as we continue to move forward? We're all talking about tasting better and what that kind of sustainable sourcing looks like. Where do you see that fitting in to your planning processes and thinking? Maybe others that Tim, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, sustainability are probably easier for me as an independent restaurant to sort of make the forefront of what I do.
Yeah.
And so through sourcing, through production, and then through wastage, things that we've added on, things like how do we compost? How do we food recycle? How do we use the outlets? Like I mentioned, we have 7 outlets. How do we use each one, but also interlink them as well to look at what our intake and what our outtake is as a food business?
Yeah.
Sustainability is even more so now is clear communication with suppliers and also where their suppliers are as well. So that's why I'd say At the moment, it's communication between what we do and what our suppliers are doing.
Yeah. And Stephen, I know that's a big role at Vacheron, something that's really important to you guys in your menu development. How do you see sustainability fitting in?
Yeah, so sustainability within our company is at the forefront. Everything we do, we've got very stringent processes. So any supplier we bring on has to jump through all the right loops to get to us before we start using them. And so it's everything we do is based around sustainability, and that's the backbone to our business. That's what we sing about, that's what we shout about, and we walk the walk, because there's a lot of people, we were discussing earlier, that there's a lot of people say this stuff, and then because it takes a little bit longer, then it falls away and people don't bother. So, but I've come up with a lot of innovative ideas for our chef sustainability-wise. I've done a menu tool for our chefs, so they've got a menu tool of, and it's sort of 10 points of how to write a greener menu. There's a headline, so, and then there's more detail on each headline.
Okay.
So it's about future 50 foods, not using the big five fish, seasonally and locally, because you'll be surprised how many asparagus you see on Christmas menus, how many strawberries you see, and things like this. And everyone laughs and everyone says about it, but then you still see it.
Still
and
order it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like that to me, that sort of thing, I don't know why you can't just say, right, you can't sell asparagus unless it's in the season. But obviously, that's a bigger conversation. But yeah, and training, masterclasses, do a lot of masterclasses around sustainability.
Yeah.
I've got another innovative innovation, which we're currently doing, which I'll go into. Now, or
yeah, go
now,
for it.
Yeah.
Go
so,
for it. Tell us about it.
So I don't know. Has everyone heard of the restaurant Silo? Yep. And Doug McMaster. So I work very closely with him, and he takes two chefs a week on a week intern. And I've done a deal with him that we have one of those places every other week for the foreseeable future. So we've got 21 chefs going down. Started at the beginning of March because he changed his team. They're on like a cycle there. So after a certain amount of years, the team sort of naturally changes, like most kitchens really. So he didn't want to do it early in the year. So we started at the start of March, and then now there's a chef going every other week for an intern. And then what they're doing, they're being challenged with a questionnaire, like a little questionnaire. And one of them is, what can you take from this no-waste restaurant? What can you take back to our industry and make a permanent change at site? And then once we're a few months in, I'm going to collate all this once they've piloted them at sites and create a rule of Doug, which we'll then roll out across the whole of our company, which is 100 sites in London. Then we're in an umbrella of CH&Co, which is it's a house of brands as such. So there's CH&Co, there's Company of Cooks, there's Gather and Gather, and they're national and international, I believe, now. So, and then we'll look to roll that out across the whole of them. Okay. Yeah, and if our 1,000 employees take that one little change into their lives, tell 3 people before you know it, one chef going to Silo has changed 4,000 people's way of thinking.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think perfect kind of segue maybe, Chris, where when you're speaking direct to consumer and we're talking about sustainability ideas and things, how do you translate that to talk to consumers at home cooking?
Yeah, great question. I think going back to your point on seasonality, because I spent so much time with the farmers, like it's all education.
Yeah.
And, you know, having spoke to, I've probably been to 40 or 50 farms across the UK, and you'd always end up having like a 2-hour conversation over dinner with a farmer. And the message that would always come back when it's in season, it tastes better and it costs less.
Yeah.
And it's so simple. And it's
yeah.
like people think strawberries are on offer because Wimbledon's on. It's because there's a glut of them and they need to get a little, oh, I'll have strawberries and cream. But it's like that education around sustainability in terms of seasonal produce. And I think people are caring more about where stuff comes from and their own responsibility to not waste. And I think one of the big trends we're seeing is what would you even call it? Your HelloFreshes, Mindful Chefs Delivered.
Yeah.
I've spoke to so many people that now use that, and the one thing they say is not even like how good the food tastes. It's always, oh, don't throw anything in the bin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a huge trend that I think that market is just going to grow. And whether the retailers might end up going into that and stuff. I think that's a big one. And if they can tie in seasonal British produce into what they're putting in the boxes, even better. So
yeah, absolutely. I guess in each of your own spaces, what sort of role does social media play? You know, there's such an influence of particularly TikTok on kind of younger generations in terms of where they want to eat, which dish they want to try, you know, what they're going to post about on social, what they're going to buy so that they can cook at home and post about it on social. How does social media influence your team and your decision making and drive you forward?
I think it's huge, to be honest. I think I'm officially old because I don't have TikTok.
Yeah.
It's like cut off at Instagram and that's where I've stopped. But no, I think as a business, we take into consideration. And again, if we go back like pre-lockdown, social media was great and we would see things as chefs and we would cook and create. But actually, I think lockdown was a huge shift within our consumer basis where actually you started to see substantial trends developing. We all know the tomato feta pasta. Asda actually did a fixed year-end promo based on that. And I think something that's been hard and is still ongoing in our industry is actually how we can add a value to the amount of hashtags a dish or a speck or whatever it is has got, because it's still quite hard to quantify that into an actual valuable output. Yeah. It's such a volatile market that moves so quickly. So we speak about Instagrammable, but is it Instagrammable or is it delicious? Because I think some of the burgers and things you see that are like this, that look cool on a page, there's no way any of us are eating them. And to be honest, it's probably not going to be very good for us if we did. So I think we're always on when it comes to social media. And I think you can start to see the things that continually come up. Yeah. I think like the pastry work, we had the Holborn dining room. Yeah. There's an absolute insurgence now of lovely pies and pâté and croûtes and things. Yeah. I think you can start to see a trend like that will continue. And naturally, we'll start to react on how we can implement some of that inspiration back into our product ranges. But it's also being smart and not trying to launch these ridiculous...
Not just chasing trends for the sake of it.
Yeah, exactly that. I think we work with a lot of partners as well, so like The Food People, Mintel, WGSN. I'm working with our insight companies and partners to actually help track and quantify. It is really useful. So, yeah, always on. I think the other side as well, we use our social media to talk about what we think should be trending as well. Yeah. We've got quite a large following, specifically on Facebook, but also growing on Insta. I think we can start to talk about what we're doing with food and how we're promoting health and sustainability. We do like our 5 for 25 deals and things like that as well, which is probably what you mentioned, Chris. It's easier for us to activate inspiration in that manner through online than it is to actually merchandise in store.
Yeah.
Like anyone who's worked with a retailer will know how hard it is to try and change anything in store ever. It's like the biggest pain in my life. But through socials, it's a really reactive and proactive way that we can bring mealtime solutions together in a way that's really easy for the consumer. So,
and it pulls on Chris's point before about the importance of trusted and, you know, meaningful voices, right?
Oh, totally. I think it's such an interesting space for food because by no means am I the best chef in the world, but I can cook. And, you know, you'll watch a video that's got 20 million views and anyone that can cook goes, bloody hell, that's going to be awful.
Yeah.
Like, why are these vegans adding miso paste to everything?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't need to be in there. Like, I like, not to knock anyone, but you hear someone go, oh, you know, add a bit of miso to that Italian tomato thing. It's like, yeah, but they've been using umami as tomatoes for, like, why are we adding it? Like, so where you get your information from, and I think social is so big now. But if you find the right sources that you believe in, then it's such a strong thing. But it's important for the big businesses to actually, I think, almost set the trends as well. Like what you guys are doing, because you have such an authoritative voice that people will listen to simply because of the brand name. So I think any brand has a bit of a responsibility to think, what's a sensible thing for us to put out as a business? And also for an individual, if you've any, you know, moral compass to give your opinion that you think's right rather than what do I think is going to get more likes or views?
Yeah.
Because it'd be easy for me to make something I think's relatively healthy and then add 10 balls of mozzarella on the top and pull it out from under the grill, because that first 3 seconds will capture attention and drive the likes up. But is that actually what I stand for, or am I just chasing numbers? So it's a really complex area, and I think almost like talking about the food trends, how things mature in terms of, like, you know, that plant-based movement is now sort of settling down and you're seeing what's right. I think it's going to happen within the food content space as well. Of it's a minefield at the minute, but I think over time it will settle and find its way.
Yeah. I think you make a really good point. We were talking a little bit yesterday on this panel around how it can be kind of a blessing and a curse for a restaurant when something goes viral on a menu, because then all of a sudden you move. So there was chat yesterday around an afternoon tea and kind of going viral with an afternoon tea, and then not then realizing the impact when you all of a sudden are doing hundreds of those a day on the flow of the kitchen, and you know that it wasn't designed to be done at that kind of volume, and how that impacts a restaurant. And so it can be that kind of blessing and curse where you capture attention, but if it doesn't then align with, you know, if you've caught their attention on something that doesn't align with your values or what you stand for, is it actually going to be meaningful long term? Can you sustain it in the pure meaning of the word sustain? Interesting. I guess, you know, we talked a little bit before around travel, around looking around the world and inspiration, and this idea that we have a much more, I think the industry is a lot more attuned to the fact that we are not just catering to like one white British consumer anymore, and starting to look more kind of globally at inspiration. How do you guys look at incorporating kind of cultural diversity into your thinking? What sort of any cuisines at the moment that you think are underexplored that you're starting to look at? You know, a lot of this trend-based stuff is looking at what we think the carousel is going to come around to in a couple years' time, so you can start kind of planning towards that. Where do you think we're going when it comes to cultural diversity? Happy for any of you to start.
Yeah, so we work, we actually work with Sabrina Gidder, who's a South Asian cook. She's just bought out a new book, not that I'm plugging it.
but you can buy Sabrina's book, it's great.
But I have got signed copies if anyone wants to buy one. And so it's really interesting because when you think of Indian food, people automatically think of a curry and that's it. But so it's really cool working with her as we're just sort of developing new dishes, seeing new ways of thinking about Indian food and bringing that to our menus. And I think, like you're saying about the culture, I think it's got natural now for us to be thinking that way of cultural differences. No sort of, it's not sausage and mash and fish and chips and that's British food now. It's, I think the whole dynamics has changed massively. And like you said earlier about the London, it's like every cuisine possible around every corner. And it's all really good. Mm. There's some really good authentic cuisines.
Yeah. I liked your point earlier around hype about regional cuisines now, kind of thinking beyond just, you know, I'm inspired by Mexican food, and instead we're now getting a lot more hyper-regional. What does Yucatan food look like? What did Baja fish tacos look like? You know, what does that mean?
Which we're just starting to look into is Ethiopian food as well. I think that one's not really been done. It's not been investigated. It's a lot of stews, spicy meats, vegetables, and things like this. So excited about looking into that currently.
Cool, Tim. You were kind of mentioning around when you're curating a team of people in your kitchen and making sure you've got those.
I mean, hotels for what they are attract worldwide customers.
Yeah,
and so you know we do want to give people a taste of something that they recognise, but also, by using the sustainability program that we have, by using local British produce and then mixing it with, I don't know, an element or an ingredient or something that's, or a preparation style sort of adds to the sort of uniqueness of what we can provide. Yeah. And that's why we sort of look for, I speak to the team members, I look at travel, we incorporate all these things to make something that's unique for a guest, but also has familiarity to them as well.
Right. Jamie, anything that you're...
Yeah, I've got a few thoughts.
Give us.
So I went to the Culinary Institute of America last year, and it was a four-day congress all around driving innovation while protecting authenticity.
Cool.
And as a major retailer, it's very, very hard for us to do an authentic version of Italian or Indian when we're Tesco. Yeah. Like, we don't look very Italian in our makeup, do we? So I think My take on authenticity is probably quite different to a restaurant setting, in the sense that we almost have to ask for permission, in the sense that, look, we're not making our Thai food in Thailand. Right. We do a good job. And I hate the term, and we have it on a lot of our products, and I hate it, like inspired, yeah. Italian inspired. Like, it's not, it's our version of Italian. Yeah. And I almost, like, I built this this picture to show my team when I come back as to, it was quite philosophical, I think, actually, for a chef, anyway. It was about how we can measure authenticity, yeah, and create our own version of it. And it was basically a pendulum. And Rennie Redzepi is a example I use, because Rennie's not cooking Scandinavian food. No. Rennie's cooking his food. But he's invested years and years learning cultures and crafts and regions and understanding to build the permission that he needed to create his own cuisine as we now know it. And now when we say Scandinavian, we think Rennie, yeah, because he's invested. And it was almost like, if this is our point now, we can only drive as far forward as we're willing to invest back, yeah, and really understand. So when we're doing an Italian ready meal, let's not just pick the cheapest tomato. Let's look at a really great Italian tomato that is sustainable, where we visit the farms, we invest in the supply chain, we make sure we're using sea freight if we can versus air freight. So we're working every step in, but we're taking that time to invest, like, into every detail of building, yeah, it. And what we end up with then on shelf is something that isn't authentically Italian or Indian, but it has meaning and we can, yeah, believe in it. I think the story we can tell then is how we drive authenticity, yeah, 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 through foods.
I think that's really interesting. And I think that point of authenticity, like, really resonates, because I think what we're also seeing is, you know, a lot of people have mixed kind of food cultures and mixed, yeah, food experiences. And so creating what is authentic food, it, yeah, you know, really. And so, but really investing in understanding your supply chain, really, mm-hmm, investing in who that history that you're building, who those voices are that you're listening, yeah, to, where that inspiration comes from. So that you've got that depth of kind of research. I like that idea of how far you look back and all of that. That's really, really interesting.
We talk about third culture cuisines.
Yes.
This is,
yes,
a terminology you're probably all familiar with. As a chef that I quite like, Gurdeep Loyal, yeah, anyone who's read his book, he does the best fried chicken sandwich that's, yeah, like buttermilk fried chicken with Indian spices on toasted brioche, katsu stando style with Maryrose sauce. And I'm like, you couldn't get more different influences into a sandwich. But that's his version of Indian food growing up as an Indian lad in Leicester.
Yeah.
But, and that's his culture. Like, you can't take that away from him. So I really like that kind of holistic view on.
And I think we're starting to see that a lot more in, yeah, chefs and, you know, in fine dining and whatnot, where people are starting to understand, yeah, that third culture.
Yeah. It's the commitment. As long as you commit and you believe in what you do, I think you can bend the rules of authenticity quite a lot.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Where are we? Key kind of question before we then open it up to the audience to see if we've got some more questions from these guys. But throughout all of this, there's this kind of undertone of the consumer, you know, and how they fit into the journey. And I think, you know, when you were talking, Tim, about hotels and this idea of, you know, you want to give them a taste of something they're comfortable with, I think the third piece of any trend conversation or any innovation conversation is, does the consumer drive us? And you know, are we giving them what they want and kind of following where the consumer is at? Or are we driving the consumer towards a kind of different way? And I guess I'm interested in your dynamic to the ultimate diner and, you know, where you meet them on that path. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah.
You're all kind of in different areas of the market, too, in terms of how you meet them and what that looks like. So, you know, each of you guys has a very different space. Chris, I'm going to start with you. You speak directly to consumers.
Yeah, so trying to think of the best way to answer that. In terms of, like, is a trend, are you giving them...
Like, are you giving them what they want?
Yeah.
And or are you kind of taking them somewhere that they weren't, that they don't even know that they want yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, it can work both ways on social media, and like that feta pasta thing, no one would have ever wanted that, but all of a sudden you're missing out if you don't try it. And a lot of time you can be leading them the wrong way to something that doesn't taste that good. But I think ultimately all of it with food, and especially social, comes back to flavor, because it's all well and good a trend being there, but if it doesn't taste good enough take away authenticity or anything like that. It's all about, is it actually enjoyable for that person at home? And it will continue and grow if it is. And if it isn't, it'll die off. So whether it's something that's blew up because something's gone viral for the sake of the visuals, or whether someone's gradually built it up, I think they're the ones that are the ones that will last, rather than something that's just popped off and everyone's jumped on it. And if people like it, they'll carry on. And so it's kind of like, it's an interesting one with food, because the world on social, like, you can't even taste it or smell it.
Yeah.
Where actually, when you bring it back to what it is, does it taste good? Yeah. Does it not? So I think it can vary one way or the other.
Stephen, how do you see that with your dining rooms? You guys have kind of two customers at the end of the day. You've got your client who, you know, who you're working for, and then you've got your diner. And do you find that you're sort of being directed by what they want, or are you leading them towards what you're hoping they would
it's
want?
It's very much a sort of a two-way relationship, really, because you've got, I always believe you've got to cook for your customer. There's no point cooking food that people don't want to eat, like you're saying, to be honest. And but then the way the world is with social, with everything being so instant, you do need to take that in consideration, that what you're cooking is relevant and on trend. I mean, Humble Crumble is a prime example. For me, it's... does everyone know Humble Crumble? No? So Humble Crumble is a, believe it or not, Apple Crumble pop-up, which has now got four or five shops in London. And it's £9 for an apple crumble in a pot with, and then there's custard on top. It's really, like you're saying,
the
it's really,
crazy.
The queues are mad, it's really Instagrammable. And then, but then we do a pop-up at work. We'll do that in our sites at half the price and the customers go mad. But we wouldn't have, if we'd done that 10 years ago, if you'd put apple crumble on, everyone would have said, what are you doing? That's from the 90s. So we're back on the roundabout again, the merry-go-round.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very much, in a nutshell, without dodging it, it's very much a two-way relationship.
Yeah.
We cook what they want, and then, and via the social media and the way the world is, they let us know what they want, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Retail, I think that's one of the most, like, interesting environments for this sort of thing, right? Because people, I spend a lot of time in rooms with sustainability leads in retail brands, and there's always this question of, like, you were talking about strawberries in December. Retailers don't take strawberries off the shelves because they sell.
Because people
want them in December. So you get this kind of merry-go-round of this push-pull of leading. How do you lead the consumer and how do you follow the consumer? And I guess you guys, as the innovation team, how do you see that?
It's huge, isn't it? Yeah. It's a minefield. So I think to frame this, we have 16 million shoppers come through our doors every single week.
Wow.
How many of us in this room don't know what we're having for dinner tonight? Because I don't
at
the moment. So, like, we are an inside business that's driven by the consumer, but sometimes the consumer doesn't really know what they want.
Exactly.
Which makes it, it makes it tricky. I think I always use a good example in here. When we did some insight around, like, premium look and feel across Tesco Finest, we asked an audience on qual and quant. So we got a really good measure, and it's like, okay, so what does premium packaging look like? Well, it's black, because black screams premium. And what color's the right one? Well, it's got to be gold, hasn't it? And, like, how would you want the artwork? It's like, well, we want, like, really big image and visuals of the products on there cooked so we can see it. And then I just bring out Charlie Bingham's, which is the complete opposite. So it's like, you can ask direct questions on a subject, but actually what people buy into is the complete opposite. So.
Totally.
Yeah, it's we play it both ways. I think we're an insight business. Everything we do is grounded in insight, but ultimately it's how you take that insight and digest that to come out with an output is the piece. And I guess that's why I've got a job, luckily, to be honest, because I speak, my chefs, actually, a lot of what we do, I'm like, look, there's four of us in the biggest retailer in the country leading our food agenda for the most part. We have to rely on our gut food as culinary experts, and then we take the insights and the info we can get to try and almost quantify our gut feel into something that we believe in, going back to that commitment piece. So, as much as we use that insight, like, our instincts come into play as well as chefs, and you kind of know from working in restaurants. I look at it slightly different. I'm like, when I worked in restaurants, I cooked the food I wanted to eat, and I was really lucky there was enough customers that also wanted to enjoy that food.
Yeah.
When you switch it now, we're feeding the nation. It's not about what I want. It's about making the right product for somebody that probably doesn't even know they want that yet.
Yeah.
And that's like at the cutting edge.
Yeah.
That's how we drive innovation.
Yeah.
Bacon sarnie's a bacon sarnie.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And I think that specific nuance around digesting, you know, what a consumer says, how you quantify those insights and what they actually do, and how, you know, and how you change minds is such a cutting edge, interesting place to be when it comes to food. I want to make sure that we open up the floor for any questions. Any questions in the room for our panel? Yes, just here. Oh, we've got a microphone coming, sorry.
Hello, my name's Nicole Strawn, and I work for a company called En Route, who supply food to the airline and aviation industry. I'm particularly interested in bakery, and I'd be really interested to hear what the panel see as the next trends for bakery and pastries. You know, are we still in sourdough land? Are we ancient grains? What do you see as the next stage specifically in that product category?
Does anyone want to jump in?
I think we're in the land of looking at the flour in more detail and how the flour's grown. Wild Farmed is a regenerative farm who, I don't know if anyone's seen it, it's actually on the Marks and Spencers. Sorry, it's sacrilege. Marks and Spencers.
What's this space?
Yeah. Marks and Spencers advert with Tom Kerridge at the moment, but it's all about regenerative farming, all different crops grown in the same field, and then it creates... The way that I was brought into it was I was given a loaf of bread and I tried it and it was a million times better than any other loaf of bread I'd eaten. So, and then, like we say, it's a flavour first, and that's how a lot of chefs buy into it. But the whole regenerative farming story around it's so cool that they plant all these different crops in a nutshell, plant all these different crops that grow and they all help each other, they all feed off each other, that regenerates the soil. The cattle then, they harvest the crop, the cattle will come along, eat the rest, and then trample down, ready for it to be planted again for the next season's harvest. So that's my insight at the moment on this.
Yeah. Jamie, do you want to add?
Yeah, I think, so slightly different angle, but like sweet bakery, is that of an interest too? Yeah, so I think this is an area I'm seeing a lot of evolution when it comes to reformulation. I think like sugar has played, sugar and salt, basically. They're probably the two hardest things to reformulate based on their functionality as well as their flavour. I think there's loads going on in the Far East at the moment when it comes to startups and techs, and actually seeing some ingredients now filter in that aren't novel, that we can use at scale, that really help us reformulate with a healthier output is something I think that's where we're going, really.
I think that's a really, both really, really good points. And I think we're seeing... Definitely in the restaurant space, the kind of increased awareness around regenerative farming and the types of grains going in and that ancient grain space playing a huge role in restaurants, like hospitality land as well. Other questions from the audience just behind in the blue shirt?
John Feeney from Griffith Foods. Question, I was at a farm yesterday and they're talking about the promotion next week for Great British Beef Week. What are you going to do to support that? That's to all of you guys. And how would you cook your steak, for example? Technique.
Shall I start?
Go for it.
Yeah. So we're probably going to support that by doing loads of good promos on beef. But I think we do loads in the agricultural space. We work very closely with supply chain around sustainable breeds and varieties. I think not beef specific, but the Narragansett turkey was a variety of turkey that we actually, it was nearly extinct. It was a dying out breed. We invested in that supply chain, built it back up over a number of years, and then haloed that for our finest chain. So it's something close to our heart. I need to read the article you sent. John sent me this article on this last night, and I should have done my homework, shouldn't I? Got to be ribeye steak, got to be medium rare, cooked on a barbecue.
Nice. Anyone else want to contribute
Yep, we use British British beef in particular. Being a Surrey restaurant, we use Surrey Farm in Guildford. So it's really hyper-local for us. And I think going back to the social media is that people aren't just interested in the end product anymore. They want to see the journey. And so we can use our socials to highlight that and really sort of get it across to the potential customers as to where everything's coming from. So just by promoting that we use these ingredients and how they get to us and our relationship directly with the farms is really a big thing for us.
I think that's a really important kind of thing to point out that we haven't really mentioned as a trend, but traceability and transparency and that kind of increasing desire for traceability, transparency, and good storytelling. And we get asked a lot around, like, how do you communicate around sustainability? And it's always, you know, transparency, traceability, and tell the story of your farmer. That's the thing that people are most interested in. They're not that interested in you telling the story of the LED lights that you've switched out, or, you know, even talking in terms of carbon, it goes over most people's heads. But if you talk about a great farmer, then it connects with people. Anybody else want to throw in anything on the beef side?
Yeah. Just medium rare. Pied de boeuf.
I think there's probably something really important to just pick up in the tone of the question, where I think often, especially when talking about trends, there's this tension between the idea of like British farming and British beef and trends around plant-based and kind of eating less meat. And I think it's really important that we start to build nuance into our conversation around less but better meat. And that can be a real win for British beef and British farming. We have some of the best farmed beef in the, you know, some of the best cattle in the world in this country. And it's really important that we don't, particularly those of us working within the sector, that we don't fight ourselves on this story because no one wins. And so when it becomes a kind of eating more plants is anti-British farmer, we all are losing the narrative, and what we're going to end up seeing are trade deals that bring in a bunch of Brazilian beef or something like that. So I think, you know, we're quite cognizant of it in the sustainability space. We absolutely want meat consumption, you know, needs to drop, but we want to do that in a way that also champions really good quality, really meaningful working with British farmers and all of that. And I think we need to keep telling that story and allow for the nuance in that story, and to not fight ourselves. The other thing is on this kind of how do you cook it thing, an interesting anecdote around really shifting, particularly from a hospitality or product development, the conversation to start thinking about carcass balance in our conversation around reducing meat consumption. So I'm going to throw out that, like, let's go for a nice braise or something of a meat cut, you know, something that we can do to start shifting the narrative towards balancing the carcasses that we're using.
This is where the restaurants help us, though, 100%. I think. 100%. Because we, Ollie at the front here, he's developed a lovely ossobuco for Tesco. It was going into something that was quite limited and small, but actually, because it's the right thing to do, it's come out of that and gone into an all-year-round range now.
Yeah.
And just bring in the spotlight to them, lesser-used cuts. Like, yeah. I don't know how many people would know, but how, going back to the beef thing, how we all manage beef, we actually buy whole cattle.
Yeah.
And then we use partners to break that down and pack. So we're responsible for the whole carcass. And actually, we don't want anything to go in the bin. So it's a huge part of everything we do across any whole cattle, pork, etc.
Yeah.
I just thought, like, coming back to our talk on trends, what's interesting is we should be using it all, but then when it becomes popular, like Bavette and stuff,
yeah.
15 years ago, you got the butchers and get it for next to nothing, and then all of a sudden that blew up, and everyone's cooking them at home, and it's on social media, and all of a sudden that's up there with the price. It's really interesting how it works, isn't it?
Yeah, I think on that as well, just to expand on beef, again, I'm drilling beef now, John, you've got me going. for us, accessibility is another thing. So Tesco Finest beef used to all be Aberdeen Angus, but actually, our service level was like 77%, which means there's a lot of people that want steak and they're not having it for dinner. Yeah. And actually, the backlash of that versus taking away the Aberdeen Angus, but having a really consistent British product that may be Hereford and maybe Aberdeen Angus, but it was consistent and it was great. I call it process over provenance, because if you imagine in restaurants, it's great. You can get incredible Italian tomatoes you handpick every time. We use Italian tomatoes in our ready meals and sauces, but actually, I've got a bit of a philosophy here that I would rather it just be a great tomato 52 weeks of the year than Italian and there's 7 weeks where it's a poor product. Yeah, and I think it is balancing sustainability, sourcing, but also consistency and provenance. It's you have to take it's back to them tick boxes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have to look at it all and you pick your wins, yeah, really, because we can't do it all the time, yeah, especially when we're feeding the nation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think emphasising your points around partnerships and how partners can really help in that. So, you know, restaurants working with others to buy whole carcasses or whatever, and using, you know, because a restaurant might not have all of those items on their menu, but working with another chain, you might get, you know, all of that mix. And so just a shout out to Oaxaca, who I know, who we've worked with for a really long time, but Oaxaca looked to take their steak taco off their menu, instead opted to switch. So having a steak taco to having a braised beef taco, yeah, where they could partner with others in their supply chain so that they're only using these cuts, still having that exact same availability for the consumer where you've got this one beef taco on the menu. It went their herd size in terms of amount of cattle being butchered for their supply chain went from something like 150 cows to 4. And so there are these like innovative ways to do this, but in partnership with others and by having conversations. I think probably time for one more question up front.
On the topic of alternative protein, something that I think was quite big a few years ago and talked about and has kind of just trickled away is insect protein. And I heard of some research going on, a PhD project into like grasshoppers in protein bars and things like that. Just interested to hear any experiences, thoughts. Do you think this will come into the UK or do you think it's just kind of too strange for the UK consumer to get used to?
I've done some mad stuff with grasshopper protein. I think I can jump in on this one. Yeah, I think it's been on our agenda for 3-4 years. We've been exploring. I've tried it in lots of different ways as well. Has anyone smelt insect, like grasshopper protein specifically? It's almost like ground coffee. It smells like chocolate coffee. And when you taste it, it tastes disgusting. You have to do a lot of work with it. I think, so we did a load of work on kind of Far East communities where there just wasn't the accessibility of like first grade animal protein, if you like. And generally, a long story short, you only choose alternative protein when you don't have the primary source there. So anywhere where you're looking globally, where there is that transitional shift, generally it's backed up with a shortage, basically. But I do think it will have a place. I think we'll start to see it coming through in performance nutrition, just based on nutrient density. The best thing I did with it, which I think was actually quite acceptable, I didn't tell people what it was and everyone liked it. I did like a garum base with IQF. I got frozen grasshoppers. I made a garum base, which is an old school fermentation process. And I almost made like a Worcester sauce, for what it's worth, that we would then use to heighten a spaghetti bolognese or like finish a sauce with, just to really elevate. So you got the goodness, but not in the way like of a deep fried crispy grasshopper. So I think we're a long way away from eating a bag of grasshoppers like we do a packet of Walkers. But I do think we will see a shift coming into performance and pet. It's massive in pet already. Yeah. So that's an area where it's established within brands.
I think the other thing too, the other role that it's really going to play is in chicken supply chains. And so replacing feed. Yeah. And there's a lot of there are currently legislation barriers to that, but that's one of the places that could be really transformative and would help to lower the carbon footprint of chicken. And if we could reduce the amount of soy that goes into chicken feed and instead replace that with insect. So that's a real big, from a hospitality perspective, I would say businesses that we work with, though, I don't know why I'm shouting out Oaxaca again, but they do a cricket dish. Crickets as a topper on one of their dishes. But for most hospitality customers that we're looking at, it's really about those supply chain benefits, and feed is a huge place. Yeah.
Soy-free chicken would be a massive huge step forward using grasshopper.
And it would be so, you know, impactful. And I think this is, again, with this maturation of the space and as people really are understanding these issues more and really putting sustainability at the forefront of their thinking, it stops being about the novelty aspect and starts being about where can we functionally make a shift. And if it's feed, the impact for all of us would be massive because people could eat chicken continually and it wouldn't have the same deforestation impacts. Great. Well, I think we're at time. Anybody want any kind of last words? No. Thank you so much. Thanks to our brilliant panel.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, before we wrap up, we have some exciting news to share. Food Matters Live is returning this autumn with events in Ascot, Manchester, and for the first time, Dublin. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Whether you're looking to solve innovation challenges, explore positive nutrition trends, or learn strategies for sourcing sustainable ingredients, these events are designed for you. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. We look forward to seeing you there.